Well, this was a special day. Not only is it the inaugural Paul A. Olson Seminar for the 2010-2011 academic year, it's the day that we officially award the Great Plains Distinguished Book Prize to Michael Forsberg for his book, Great Plains, America's Lingering Wild. Michael is a Nebraska native and graduate of the University of Nebraska. He's a professional photographer, and anyone who has read the book knows that he's an accomplished author. His photographs have appeared in National Geographic, Natural History, Audubon, and National Wildlife, as well as in books published by the Smithsonian and National Geographic. His work can be seen in many collections throughout the world, as well as in the Michael Forsberg Gallery down in the Haymarket. And the collection of this art museum contains several of his works. Michael lives in Lincoln with his wife and business partner, Patty, daughters Elsa and Emmy, and he says three unruly dogs. So, Michael.
Thank you very much. Everybody hear me? Yes? Okay. Yeah, our one of our unruly dogs is in his cage, as we call it right now, back in our bedroom because he's been a little naughty when we leave. So Linus, we have Linus, Lucy, and Charlie, and Linus is in the doghouse right now. We'll see what he's done when we get back. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here today among honestly, family and friends and colleagues. I went to the University of Nebraska, as Jim said, and was a geography major, and I don't think I took a writing class, photography class, speaking class, or business class in my life, and yet here I am today talking to you about a book that I never thought that I would publish or put together, and the reason why I'm here is quite honestly, because of a lot of the folks here in this room that directly and indirectly have helped me in a lot of ways. And when you do a book like this, it really ceases to become your book very quickly, and it becomes a whole community's book up and down the plains. And folks here at the University of Nebraska and others that I see out here in this audience, there's no way in the world we would have been able to pull this off without you. So it's not just an honor, but a real blessing to be here today. What I'm going to do today is try to build the backstory of this book. How in the world did we put this together anyway? Tell you a few stories along the way, and then finish with a really lovely slideshow set to music that my wife Patty produced. That's about 12 minutes long, and it takes you on a journey through the Great Plains of North America. But where I want to start is I want to start with the root of this book. And the root of this book really began back in 2000. And I was working with University of Nebraska researchers as a photographer who were studying burrowing owls on prairie dog towns in western South Dakota. And I was there for a better part of a summer living with these guys as they studied these owls and how they lived their lives. And there were two things that I took away from that summer, and they both sort of came back to one experience that I had. And it was the very first time I photographed one of these little owls. And if you know burrowing owls, they're about like this tall. You know, they're only about 9 inches tall, but very fierce little creatures. And I had set up a blind on this prairie dog town, not very far away from one of these burrowing owl holes, which, you know, in these owls, they don't nest in trees, they nest in holes in the ground. And I was waiting for this owl to come up and show itself in the twilight of the setting sun out on the South Dakota prairie. And you know, the sun was just setting, and I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and all of a sudden, here came up the first little patch of feathers, and then came up the eyes, and then came up the beak, and then came up the whole body. And this owl just sort of emerged like a, you know, like an actor on a stage coming up from a platform from below, and stood outside that burrow and looked at me square in the eye through this, you know, as my eyes were trained on this little owl through this big long telephoto lens. And the owl lifted up one leg, see if I can do it without falling over, lifted up one leg like this, and then took its wings and stretched like this and bent down and just peered into my eye. And if you've ever looked through one of these long telephoto lenses, like, holy smokes, this is right there. And that fierce gaze of this tiny little owl pierced my soul like nothing else ever has in my entire life. It's a moment that I'll never, ever forget. And at that instant, it showed me the wild spirit that's still lingering on the Great Plains of North America and really planted a seed for me to do this book. Here's a picture of the owl. The second thing that struck me besides this owl's fierce gaze was the amazing diversity of life that I saw out on the prairie. I mean, my goodness, you know, day after day, week after week, golden eagles, ferruginous hawks, prairie falcons, tiger salamanders, swift fox, coyotes, great blue herons, great plains toads, dragonflies, just this whole diversity of life out there, unlike any other place I've ever been before, you know, outside of the Arctic and Alaska. Yet, I knew as I looked off in the distance on that thin ribbon of highway that was where there was motorcycles and cars driving back and forth between Wall and Sturgis, that when those people looked out over that same landscape, they were probably like I was at one time. And I'd look out over this place and I'd think that there was absolutely nothing out there at all. We have a perception versus reality problem, I think, here in the Great Plains of North America. It's flyover country, one big cornfield, a place you drive through, not to. But those of us here in Nebraska, we like to say out here, the sky is our mountains and the prairie is our sea. It's not the Rockies, it's not the Pacific Northwest, it's not the Grand Canyon. And you can't appreciate it from a roadside pullout in 5 minutes. You have to linger. You have to linger and get to know this place. You have to spend time. It's like getting to know an old friend. The more time you spend with this person over a lifetime, the more layers you peel away, the more beauty that you see. And then in those beautiful moments, this place can be every bit as remarkable as any other place, not just on the face of the continent, but on Earth. So that was back in 2000. Fast forward to 2005, when I was finally able to put together a team of writers, put together the idea, and get some funding to really head off down the road and do this book for real. And the goal of the book was twofold. One was to put a face to the lingering wild that's still left here on the North American continent and the Great Plains and build appreciation for those wildlife and landscapes. And the other thing was to see what sort of kind of shape the ecosystem is in today, what the challenges were, what the challenges are, and maybe what the challenges will be in the future. I found the first... I'm a photographer that writes, but I don't claim myself to be a writer, so we needed writers, and the first writer that I reached out to was a guy named Dan O'Brien, who's a rancher in western South Dakota. He's also a novelist. He's a wildlife biologist. And he's one of the great thinkers on the plains today, I think. He wrote a memoir called Buffalo for the Broken Heart, which was one book South Dakota last year. It's actually, his book was published several years prior. But it's become sort of a clarion call for Great Plains and its lingering wildness. And it took me about 6 months to convince Dan that he needed to do this project with me. But we were finally able to get him to come on board. And then... the second person was somebody that came on board much later in the project when we realized that Dan was writing beautiful essays and I was taking photographs, but we needed some meat on the bone. I don't think in conservation today you can do anything effectively if you don't know where you've been. And so I reached back out to my old, and I don't mean old, David, but my, I got to stop using that, my undergraduate advisor in college, David Wishart, who's sitting in the back here that most of you know who David is, and I think we met at a coffee shop, and I was probably as nervous for that as I was asking my wife to marry me, and asked David if he would write some essays for this book, and he gratefully said that he would. And did a fabulous job. And then we asked Ted Kooser, U.S. Poet Laureate here in Nebraska, to join forces as well and write a foreword. So get this loose team of guys all piled together, and off we went. And so in order to do a book, being a geography major, I try to teach geography, I guess, through the photography that I do. And so the first question that you ask is, where are the Great Plains anyway? So I went to David, and I said, David, we need a map of the Great Plains of North America. Can you provide us with one, to sort of encompass this place? So this is the first map that he mentioned. Thanks a lot. Right. That's 50 different published versions of the Great Plains regional boundary done by geographers. But David, with his wisdom, I think, continues to teach me throughout my life in different little spurts. And I think the point of this whole map, and the reason why it was in the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains, which he edited, was, to me, the point is that there's no hard edges out here. It's this ocean of grass. It's this vast expanse where grass rules over trees, but land's just an anchor for a sky. It's sort of a region like the Deep South. When you go down into the Deep South, you don't cross some line, and on the interstate or at a highway, it says you're in the Deep South now. It's a place that you know that you've gotten into the Deep South because you can feel it. It's when you start seeing grits on the menu. It's when you start hearing Elvis on the radio every other song. It's that sort of connection that plays itself out in the Deep South that has a different feel for it than other places do. And I think the Great Plains is just like that. You can't necessarily define it on a map, but you know it when you're there because you can feel it deep in your bones. Well, that was fine enough explanation for me and justification to use a map like this, but our publisher, University of Chicago Press, thought differently about it. They said that's a nice, quaint map, but you need something that's a little more tangible. So since this was an ecosystem approach to this book, and we were looking at the natural history of this place, we went to the Nature Conservancy. The Nature Conservancy has more boots on the ground with grassland conservation in the continent than any other organization I know, and they've done a lot of hard study, and they've done a lot of good map making on the Great Plains. And so as they've been working towards conservation efforts here in the heart, they have put together their own map of the Great Plains, and this is the map that they put together. Now, that's 1 million square miles. It stretches from southern Canada to northern Mexico, and from the foothills of the Rockies in the west to the eastern shoulder, or the western shoulder of the Tallgrass in the east. If it was its own country, it would be the 10th largest in the world. Pretty significant place. Its building blocks were constructed millions of years ago. Vast inland seas, Rocky Mountain uplift. But what we see today on the Great Plains is a relatively young ecosystem that formed since the end of the last ice age, just 10,000 years ago, the skin of it anyway, shaped by glaciers and native grazers, fire, extremes of temperature and drought in this harsh continental climate. There's hundreds of natural communities. There's thousands of species. Great rivers running like ladder steps up and down the plains. Let's see if I can get this to work here. The prairie potholes in the north, the Playa Basins in the south, and let's not forget the Holy Grail of the High Plains, the Ogallala Aquifer, which stretches from southern South Dakota all the way down into West Texas and has more water, or has as much or more water in it than one of our Great Lakes. So imagine in your mind's eye, less than 200 years ago, the Great Plains was perhaps one of the greatest grassland ecosystems on the face of the earth. 30 million plus bison, millions of elk, pronghorn, and deer, billions of prairie dogs, massive migrations of birds and beasts and fish, plains grizzlies, prairie wolves, and this rich matrix of indigenous cultures all moving in this dynamic rhythm with the harsh cycle of the seasons for thousands of years. Then in a brief historic moment, as America and Canada grew west, the country filled in, and much of that wild grandeur was suddenly gone. bison went from 30 million down to less than 1,000. 98% of all prairie dog towns disappeared. Top predators like bears, wolves, eliminated. Native American cultures marginalized. Well, what happened? Part of the reason David's essays are in this book is to tell what happened, tell that story, and he weaves a story that takes us really from the ancient past of the Great Plains up to present, and we illustrate those essays with a lot of historical photographs that John Carter with the State Historical Society provided for us, as well as the National Archives. So, you know, we went from a culture here. This is, you remember Albert Bierstadt, the great landscape painter? Well, he was also a photographer, and he went on the Frederick Lander expedition in 1859 that headed west. And this photograph was taken in western Nebraska and is one of the earliest known photographs along the North Platte River Valley of a Sioux Indian village. This book takes us from there to here. This photograph is in Roosevelt County, New Mexico, which is on the eastern border. It's the heart of the Dust Bowl. The gentleman on the left there is holding out his arm, showing where the topsoil used to be. The gentleman in the middle is sitting on a tuft of prairie grass that avoided the plow. This all happened back in the Dust Bowl years, but this photograph was actually taken 20 years later in 1957. So you can see the effect of probably plowing up land in places that never should have been plowed. So let's fast forward to today right now. Today, the Great Plains is a vitally important working landscape. It helped grow a country. It helps feed a world, and increasingly now it's being asked to fuel our energy needs. It's roughly 50% of it's in cropland. That's the straw-colored is the cropland. There's 5,600 communities, give or take, in the Great Plains that total about 23 million people. I was in Los Angeles, California a few weeks ago talking on the Great Plains book, and there are roughly 23 million people in the Los Angeles basin alone. But you can see his settlement patterns have gone sort of east to west, haven't they? They worked along rivers, which were, you know, where trails went, and then railroads went, and now our highways and interstates went. So to connect those lines is the grid of roads. It's roughly 100,000 miles of highways, U.S. highways, state highways, and interstates in the Great Plains. There's also over 4,000 dams in the Great Plains. Now, I'm not sure what's going on up in Canada. I think they included beaver dams in this data set. I know there's not that many dams in Canada, but I haven't been able to change it yet. So, but anyway, the hydrology has been affected. And this is oil and gas development. As of about 2005, from 1859 to present. Then you layer over on top of that wind. That's 2007. Those are wind farms that are either in existence or are on the table to be put up. And then you put all that stuff together, and that's what the Great Plains of North America looks like. And so from a conservation standpoint, from an ecosystem standpoint, you can see why a lot of these native creatures that evolved over thousands of years to move and be able to have freedom to roam over large distances being a key survival quality have been, you know, in many cases compromised or eliminated altogether. And now the Great Plains is considered one of North America's most altered and endangered ecosystems. It's also often overlooked and misunderstood by people from the outside looking in. So you can see the conservation challenges that we have today to try to keep these systems still in place, try to keep these creatures still around, and try to keep large landscapes still functioning. So through the lens of conservation, the bad news is, over these last 4 years of work on this project, is that in some places it's a train wreck. But now that I've depressed you, let me offer you the good news, and that is that in a lot of places it's not. and all is not yet lost on the prairie, and there's still this lingering wild that survives, and there's this idea of conservation that's still alive, and restoration efforts are growing, and it's not coming from some government directive from the top down, but it's coming from the bottom up, from people as firmly rooted in the soil as the prairie is itself. And to me, I think that's a good thing. And the best long-term hope we have working in this landscape and keeping these elegant natural systems together so that they support us in all the things that we use this land for is that sense of community. And there's also a sense of community here in the Great Plains that I find quite compelling, that's very different than a lot of other places in the country that I've traveled. So let me shift gears here for a minute. By the end of 2008, early 2009, I traveled roughly 100,000 miles and taken 70 trips throughout the plains. I shot about 30,000 images, went through three sets of tires, and went through 1.5 Suburbans. When I went to all these places, I oftentimes didn't know what I was going to take, so this is usually what we took. This is our front yard at home. And there is everything in here, from blinds to kayaks to canoes to tents to, you know, all sorts of stuff in here. And strangely enough, all of this could either fit in and or on top of that Suburban, including this guy, Bill Hager, who is my field assistant through about half of this project, who is a retired helicopter pilot from the Army National Guard, who was a great right hand going through this journey with me. The two most important pieces of equipment in here are duct tape right there and Tabasco sauce right there, which made my cooking taste halfway as decent. Out here in the Great Plains, North America, everything seemed like it evolved with great eyesight, runs fast, lives in holes in the ground, and is hunted. So it's not like driving down Yellowstone National Park or Ding Darling National Wildlife Refuge in Florida, where all the animals are acclimated to human presence on the side of the road. Had to use a lot of blinds. This is the get-up. This is sort of the uniform that I'd put on often. It's a little 3D camo suit. I learned you don't walk into the Bosselman truck stop at 3 o'clock in the morning wearing one of these things. You scare the lady behind the counter, and sheriff gets called and all that stuff. next slide, honey. We used a lot of blinds. Here's an example of one. This is out on a prairie dog town in eastern New Mexico, and that's basically just a tent, small little tent just big enough for me to sit in. And sometimes you'd sit in this, you'd put the tent out on the landscape days in advance, you'd move it closer to what your target was going to be, and then at the right moment, you'd get into this tent and you'd stay there. You'd wait until the animals would come in, and then you wouldn't leave until they would leave. Sometimes that would be a couple minutes, sometimes it would be a couple hours. In one instance, it was over a day. Lots of times in blinds, this is what the inside of one looks like. This isn't actually that same tent blind. This is one that's on a cliffside across from an eagle's nest. It's made out of plywood, which makes it cattle-proof because cows like to lay on blinds, eat blinds, all that sort of stuff. But inside there's water and there's a few other little accoutrements and a camera on a tiny little tripod, and that's it. But these are the sorts of photographs that you're able to get using blinds. You're able to look. This is a golden eagle nest. Here's the one from the year before. Here's the one this year. And these are two young golden eagles sitting there stretching their wings. And you're able to photograph things like Great Plains raptors that you'd never be able to just by standing outside next to your truck or on the road. Here's another photograph. This is of ferruginous hawks, one of the largest grassland hawks in North America, bringing in prey to mostly fledged young on the edge of a cliff out in Box Butte County, Nebraska. Sometimes we'd make material blinds out of the materials at hand. This is on a little slough, warm water slough, in the western sandhills of Nebraska where trumpeter swans in the depth of winter would come and stay for months at a time. And they'd come and they'd use this area as a day use area where they'd come in and feed on aquatic plants. So they'd build this little blind out of grass, meadow grass, and hay and chicken wire and all that stuff and put it together. And I'd slide in and out of this thing each day. And I'd have to crawl on my hands and knees going through. You've seen the imprints of sea turtles coming up the beach, you know, to lay their eggs. Well, This is sort of my imprint. It looks like that, going through the snow all the way to this blind in the distance. They had been at this place almost the entire winter, and this blind had been in place the whole time. And when I got out there to this ranch along Blue Creek in the western Sandhills, for the whole week I was there, the swans didn't come in. The day that I left, Myron Peterson, my rancher friend, called me and said they were back. So as a photographer, you oftentimes fail miserably, which I have many, many times throughout my life, and you only see our successes on these pages, but it teaches you something. The other thing we had to do is embrace technology a little bit, because to photograph a lot of grassland birds, for instance, or animals at dens, you couldn't be there. There was no way you could be there. There's no way you could see them sometimes. So we would work with biologists and researchers by planting little cameras, dress them up in camouflage, and put them down in the grass with a radio transmitter, and then walk away and at a great distance fire the camera remotely. And we were able to get pictures like this. That's a northern pintail duck that's on a nest in the northern in North Dakota, in the Missouri Coteau. And it's important to show this because most people think that ducks just live in and around the water. As it is, pintail ducks are grassland ducks, and they will nest anywhere from a half mile to almost a mile away from water sometimes. You know, so when we talk about plowing up prairie but leaving the wetlands, we're plowing up the nurseries, we're plowing up eggs, we're plowing up an important part of life for the duck factory that is the Dakotas and other places in the northern plains. These are photographs of swift foxes at the den. You know, and again, these are remotes. There's no way I could have just been laying there photographing these things. So technology, as much as I don't like it, you have to embrace it because it allows you to do something in a very quiet way, undisturbed. And these cameras don't make any noise at all when the camera goes off. So just a series of these. That's a mom. And then that's one of the pups. And here's another picture of one of the pups sleeping. Another thing... What else? Is as a photographer, when you go to a place and you start photographing something, you want to tell a story and you want to tell it completely. So, you know, we know about the snow geese migration. We know about the big migration of all winged creatures coming through central Nebraska in the springtime. Well, this is on a place called Holteen Marsh, which is in the Rainwater Basin. And this little white line here are all snow geese. And then up in the air, these are all snow geese, Canada geese, white fronts, few pintails, and so forth, that are all just moving up and down like this throughout the day. It's a nice picture, and there's lots of ways to talk about, you know, how to show a big group of animals doing something. You can get at it from a big landscape scale. You can get at it from just photographing after they had all left, just all the little, you know, pieces of feathers and down that have gathered along the shoreline. You can get at it by photographing them as they're lifting off like that. You can get at it as they're flying off across a sun that's covered in clouds. But sometimes now you can do video too. Here's a look at this last year. It keeps going up and up and up, higher and higher. Okay, and here's one more clip. They estimate that it was roughly a million birds. And I know I shouldn't quit my day job as a still photographer because I'm not very good at the video, but sometimes now today as a photographer, wildlife photographer, myself, Joel Sartori, and others are using video more to help tell a more complete story. And so this was 90 miles away. How about here at home in Lincoln? See this little guy right here? That's a chimney swift. They migrate down into South America in the wintertime, but they come back to Lincoln in the summers. Here's a picture, a little closer picture of them here. They look like a flying cigar. They eat bugs. They sort of do the day job for bats. Bats are flying around at night, collect maybe 3,000 insects a night. These guys do about the same amount during the day, and they're finding that they may go 9,000-10,000 feet up in the column to catch insects. So one of the places that they roost in Lincoln, Nebraska is at Irving Middle School. Here it is, and there's this Irving Middle School was built back in the 1920s, I believe, and this smokestack, which isn't used anymore, is their roost. There's a photograph of it. Here's a photograph of these birds starting to come back to the roost, but it's really great with video. At sunset, they just start coming in these big swirling clouds from all over the city, and some of them, they're just dropping out of the sky. And you see some of them as they pass over this chimney, some of them disappear, and others keep going. And then in the mornings, I hear that they just like they're shot with slingshots coming out of the chimney and go out during the day. And then they never sit because they can't perch like a regular bird does. They have to cling like this. So they fly all day long. And I heard from a couple neighbors around there that in the spring when these guys come back, they'll oftentimes see them flying over the top of the canopy in the country club neighborhood, picking off in midair, breaking off little twigs at the top of the canopy of the tree, which they use to combine with saliva to build their nests inside these chimneys. Another thing that we're doing now is using a lot of time lapse. This is taking the same picture as bison graze across the prairie in South Dakota. This is only over about 10 minutes. Bison graze a lot different than cattle do in a lot of respects. Bison are always on the move. So today we're working on more and more in the plains, trying to put time-lapse cameras out in places to see the ebb and flow of a river like the Platte, a pothole up in North Dakota, prairie species, a prairie dog town. This was a prairie dog town in 2007 up in South Dakota. This is a prairie dog town, the same look, the same aspect today, 2 months ago after plague had gone through and wiped out most all the prairie dogs. Prairie dogs are grazers. They clip grass. If you flip back and flip forward, wouldn't it have been interesting to have a time-lapse camera trained on that over these last 3 years that take a picture a day and then crunch it all together to see that that dynamic rhythm of what's happening out on the plains? So those are some of the things that we're embracing today. The final thing that we used in this book was something called camera traps. And camera traps are just like if you cross over an infrared beam that's armed for a burglar. Burglar crosses the beam, the alarm goes off in your house. Same thing with these camera traps. An animal crosses an infrared beam, and picture goes off. Takes a picture with the camera. And so the one thing I hadn't photographed in this project was a bobcat. We had gotten grizzly bears and mountain lions and other sorts of creatures that you wouldn't otherwise see, but not bobcats. So out at Spring Creek Prairie, we set one of these up as one of the last things that we hope to capture for the book. And so this is what a camera trap looks like. It's just a box. And inside, my instructions. And then a real camera, just a little digital SLR that's in here. And then this stuff is hardwired to these to these infrared transmitters and flashes and so forth. And here is the setup out at Spring Creek, where there's this game trail, and there's the camera in the box, and then there's an infrared transmitter and a receiver, and then a flash there and a flash there, and everything's all hooked together. So if something steps over that log, the camera will take a picture. We put this out in October, early October. And for the first 2+ months, this is what we got. Absolutely nothing. Now, I don't know if it was the prairie fairies or my friends playing tricks on me or whatever it was, but every time I went out, there were pictures, but there was nothing on it. And then after the turn of the year, we started to get pictures. Here's the first one. Raccoon, little bunny rabbit. It's Farmer Jones' cat, Farmer Jones' dog. Yeah, Farmer Jones, right. And then in early March, University of Chicago called and they said, we got to be done with the photographs. We're, you know, pull the plug, that's it. And we hadn't gotten anything. We hadn't got bobcats to that point. So I went out, and true story, literally went out, and there were two frames on the back of the camera. This was the first one. And then this was the second one, taken about an hour later. And that became one of the pictures in the book that people have been drawn to more than just about anything. And for me, it was really personal because for two reasons. And one was that same look that we began with that burrowing owl, with that fierce gaze, with that wildness in its eyes, the same look that I see in this bobcat's eye. And secondly, the last picture for this book was also just taken 15 minutes from our home here in Lincoln, on a restored prairie that's been built by a community and protected by a community and loved by a community. And so I think that was really, really special. What do we got? the last picture. This is Patty and I's daughters, Elsa and Emmy. Elsa on the left, Emmy on the right. They're holding up bison skulls at Dan O'Brien's ranch. And the thing I want people to understand with this book is that when I began taking pictures a long time ago, it was all about me. And as soon as we had children, it became all about them. And I simply don't want them to grow up, or anybody else's kids to grow up, understanding this place in the Great Plains just in a history book or in a museum. I want them to be able to see cranes like fall like autumn leaves against a prairie sunset on the Platte River. I want them to be able to get lost in a tall grass prairie on a summer's day, or to hunt or hike or fish or seek solitude or pray in these wide open spaces that we call home. And I think it's important to argue and have dialogue about science and economics, but in the end, I think it gets down to something deeper than that. And I think this natural heritage that we have here is something that I fear we're in danger of losing before we understand its value. And I've probably learned the most from a lot of the ranchers and their families that I've been lucky enough to spend time with over the years doing this project, and that is a very simple thing that they say, and that is that there's no free lunch. You take care of the land, and the land takes care of you. And I think that's something that we can all understand. So I want to end with now this slideshow. It'll take you on a journey through the plains, and I'll walk you through it as we go. And John Muir, the great early day conservationist of California, said a long time ago, he said, we need bread, but we also need beauty. And I think that maybe is as important a slogan today, 120 years later, as it's ever been. So let me show you a little bit of your Great Plains here. And where we're going to start is where that burrowing owl photograph was taken in western South Dakota, in a place called Kanata Basin, which is where black-footed ferrets were reintroduced back in the early 1990s and are making a life out on the prairie today. These guys eat prairie dogs, so they're shaped sort of like a little sausage out there. There's about 300 of them left in the wild. But there's over 130 species, vertebrate species, that exist in these prairie dog towns, in these big prairie dog towns in western South Dakota. So they're very important, not to mention bison. Bison are amazing athletes. A bull can stand 6 foot high at the shoulder, run 35 miles an hour, weigh nearly a ton, and can jump over a 6 foot high fence. I had a rancher friend of mine tell me once, he said, if you look off in the distance and you see a bunch of dots out there on the landscape and you can't tell if they're buffalo or if they're cattle, he said, look down at your boots. And then 3 minutes later, look up. If they're still there, they're cattle. Because bison are always, always moving. This is Wind Cave National Park in the southern Black Hills of South Dakota. And this is from that group of photographs of burrowing owls out on those prairie dog towns back in 2000. These guys will migrate down to Mexico in the wintertime. This was on this guy's very first attempt at flight. He's flapped his wings and he flew up about 5 feet and went, oh crap, and fell back down and sort of looked around like that. Prairie rattlesnakes, very important part of the ecosystem. This is up in Grasslands National Park, which is a dedicated park to the prairies in Canada, one of the last big chunks left. This is along the Milk River in southern Alberta, and this is the White Cliffs in the upper Missouri, where we'll be heading next week, where Lewis and Clark wrote so eloquently in their journals about the wildlife that abounded. People think of elk as being creatures of the mountains, but they're also creatures of the plains. Think of mountain lions as being in the mountains, but they're also creatures of the plains, and in some places they're starting to come back in these quiet, remote places. Not every place they're welcome, of course. These ferruginous hawks, like I said, they're the largest hawk in North America, and they mostly nest on the ground. These guys I found rimmed in cactus. Then you have the golden eagle. This is Agate Fossil Beds National Monument out in western Nebraska. The prairie is sort of like the desert. When the rains come, the flowers bloom, and everything hurries up, does what it needs to do very quickly. Some ranchers' friends in South Dakota. Hunters have carried the badge for conservation for nearly 100 years here in the Great Plains. The sharp-tailed grouse hunt, A small little family of prairie dogs here. A lot of people think prairie dogs hibernate in the wintertime. They don't. Pronghorn cut from the fabric of these Great Plains. They can see up to 2 miles. So if you see them, it's likely that they've seen you first. They also run 60 miles an hour. Prairie falcon can dive at roughly 200 miles an hour over these great landscapes in the Dakotas. This is over the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the wintertime, an old mother cottonwood tree sort of shaped by the wind. And a lot of these old homesteads that are left on the landscape, you sort of see wildlife come back. These are swift fox. They're true prairie foxes. They're a little smaller than a red fox. They're about the size of your house cat, but they're 100% dog. They're funny to watch. They're almost like clowns. This is the Powder River Basin of eastern Wyoming. That's coal bed methane development along the Powder River. That's a Great Plains toad. Now we're moving up into the Dakotas, into the prairie pothole region. It's about 300,000 square miles of potholes shaped by glaciers. Issues up there include loss of wetlands, a lot of plow up going on now at a really high rate of speed in some very sensitive areas. But it's also America's duck factory, so about half of all ducks in North America breed in the prairie potholes of the Dakotas and southern Canada. I don't know if there's more rich place to see ducks, waterfowl, and shorebirds than these prairies up in the Dakotas. They sort of remind me of the sandhills in Nebraska, except they have rocks in it, because those rocks have been dropped by the glaciers many years ago. It's very much an agricultural landscape, too. These potholes go dry, usually in late summer. These are northern harriers, marsh hawks, some people call them. Their nests are about as big as a trash can lid turned upside down, put out in the prairie. The largest pelican, white pelican colony in North America is in the plains in North Dakota. And western grebes, which are the largest of all grebe species. Here they're doing their mating dance. Where these guys exist, there's still good water quality, so they're a good sign. And then those little LBJs, those little brown jobs that fly up at your feet that you can't identify when you're out birding, that's these guys. They're Baird sparrows and Sprague's pipits that make their nests in the grass. And we go from these tiny little guys up to big, big creatures. The last place where grizzly bears still come down to the plains, and this is off the Rocky Mountain front in Montana out on these short grass prairies, where these bears will still live most of their lives, only hibernate in the mountains, but spend most of the rest of their time out on the plains and the wetlands. So do moose, black bear, lynx, elk, stuff that you normally don't associate with grasslands, at least now. It's an amazing landscape. And it doesn't just connect the landscape spatially this way over the plains, but it also connects from the mountains down. So you have migratory corridors going north and south and east and west. 4 grouse species in the Great Plains, including the sage grouse, the snowy owl that comes down sometimes out of the Arctic, and the second longest migration of any ungulate species in North America is the pronghorn that move out of the Canadian prairies into Montana in the wintertime, sometimes traveling 500 miles round trip. The only species that travels further is caribou up in the north. Now we're in the Nebraska sandhills, where these waters are kept open by powerful springs in the winter that are amazing refugia for all sorts of waterfowl from all over the continent. We always think of shorebirds as being along shorelines, along beaches, but a lot of them nest in the prairies of the plains. American avocets, long-billed curlews, whimbrels, marbled godwits, all these creatures nest here. The Nebraska sandhills, 20,000 square miles, it really reminds me of an ocean of grass, you know? It's of all the places that I traveled in the plains, it's still the place, maybe it's because I'm a Nebraskan, but it's still a place that strikes me most, and it's one of our greatest treasures and has been protected so well with good stewardship over the years by those ranchers that call this place home. Now we're trucking down into the southern plains and the high plains of West Texas and eastern New Mexico, where water is definitely at a premium, but there's life down there too, a whole suite of other species of birds, mammals, and just a little bit different feel to it. It's a little bit more minimalist landscape, but wherever there's water, there's life in the high plains. Mexican free-tailed bats, wind development, which we can talk about in a little bit. Lesser prairie chickens, which are like our graters up here, just a little bit different species. Roadrunners in a peach bucket. The farthest south that we went in this book was the Janos grasslands of northern Mexico and the Caprock Canyonlands of West Texas, John Wayne country. Now we're moving up into the Platte River. 500,000 cranes, millions of waterfowl. It's the pinch in the hourglass of the Central Flyway. Last year at Audubon's Rose Sanctuary, 60 different countries had visitors visit the Platte River in Nebraska. Now we're finishing up in the tall grass prairies where the last of the least is, where there's still, in certain streams, fish that look just like that, believe it or not, that are not any bigger than my pinky. But these little native, endemic Great Plains minnows, fires used as a management tool along with grazing to keep these grasslands healthy and to restore them for things like the box turtle here, the tiger salamander, our Missouri River here along the Nebraska-South Dakota-Iowa border where there's pallid sturgeon that are 60 million years old and are about as large as I am, least terns and piping plovers that they're still trying to protect, greater prairie chickens. Now we're finishing up in western Minnesota where they're struggling to keep the prairies that they still have in existence. That's a western prairie-fringed orchid, endangered species. And there's a wolf, one of the last places wolves are still on the plains. So that's your Great Plains today.